Good morning, Council. Can you both hear me? Good, good. We're going to go through a little demonstration about how we keep time when we're doing Zoom oral arguments. When it's time for you to start, if you look in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you're going to see a green start sign, and I will also urge you to begin. When you have 5 minutes to go on your argument, you'll see a yellow 5 minute sign. When it's time to stop, you will see a red stop sign. I will pretty much hold you to that sign, the red stop sign, unless you are answering the question of a justice, and then I want you to complete your answer. So don't stop when you see the red sign. But once you've answered that question, I'll pretty much rein you in. So we will mind the time by the cards that we'll be seeing. Are you both ready to proceed? All right, then I will call our second case of the day, State versus Lix. And Attorney White, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Mm-hmm. May it please the court, Catherine White for the petitioner, Jordan Lickus. This case is about who decides whether a term of probation has been successfully completed. If the probation agent decides, Mr. Lickus wins. If the sentencing judge decides, Mr. Lickus wins. The only way that Mr. Lickus loses is if the state convinces you that a prosecutor can come in and unilaterally veto the decision of both the agent and the judge. I explained in the briefs why the plain language of the expungement statute requires satisfaction of conditions ordered by the court and not rules imposed by the DOC or its agents. I think it's a pretty straightforward analysis, and so I'm not going to bore you with simply repeating it here today, although I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have on that issue. But what I'd like to focus on today is the policy, why the legislature wrote the statute the way that it did, and why it makes sense for us to interpret the statute according to its plain meaning.
Counsel, I would like to be bored with the with the textual question here. I'm more interested in that than the policy question, so I understand they can be helpful. So it seems that the law here does pretty plainly set out in a couple of instances that the department can set conditions of probation, and using that term. 27309 says that, you know, quite directly and clearly. And there's a number of other statutes that do that as well. And I might get to those in a minute, but I'd like to hear your response to that point that it says 27309 3D talks about conditions of probation set by the department. Why would we not understand that conditions of probation in the statutes at least may include at least some conditions set by the department, and that it's not exclusive to conditions by the court?
Within Chapter 973, which is where the expungement statute lives, the statutes routinely use the term conditions to refer to those things ordered by the court, and the term rules to refer to those requirements imposed by the DOC or its agents. Absolutely, both the court and the DOC have an important role to fulfill in explaining to the probationer what he or she must do or may not do. And both of those roles work well together.
And I just want to back up, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond. I thought I heard you say that it refused to things set by the department as rules and by the court as conditions, but it doesn't do that. It actually says in 973093D, conditions of probation can be set by the department.
Yes. So in 973.09, there is, I'm going to look up exactly which one you're referring to here.
Yeah, sorry, 973093D.
Yes.
And then you look at 3 and 4. The probationer has satisfied all conditions of probation that were set by the sentencing court. And 4, the probationer satisfied all rules and conditions of probation that were set by the department?
Yes. So this is, as far as I know, the sole location within the statute that refers to conditions of probation set by the department rather than the court. It's an anomaly.
Let me take you to a few others. If you go to Chapter 304 of the statutes, if you go to 304.06 and you go to Section 1Q, it's talking about, you know, if you go to 304.06, 1Q sub B, and it talks about what the parole commission or the department may do with regard to serious child sex offenders. And the end of the second sentence in sub B there says, this paragraph does not prohibit the department from requiring pharmacological treatment using certain drugs as a condition of probation. If you go as well, you see the exact same language used in 301 when it refers to the department in several situations. And I can point you to those as well. And I also want to, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to throw all this at you, but I want to throw it all at you because I'm really interested in the textual question here. I also, if you look at the divisions of hearings and appeals procedures for corrections hearings, which are administrative rules that have been promulgated in relation to 973.09 and 10, those are the statutes that are listed there. There's a definition of conditions. The definition of condition in HA 2.02 is specific regulations imposed on the client by the court or department. And actually, there's a separate definition for rules. So it's interesting. It seems that there are rules that are written departmental regulations applicable generally, but might apply to a specific client. But conditions are client-specific ones set by the court or the department. And that all of those are grounds potentially for revocation, because it says rules or conditions later on, and I can put you other statutes. But there's actually a number of statutes and places in the law that seem to refer to the fact that conditions of probation include conditions that include things set by the department. Those are conditions of probation.
Certainly, you've pointed to several instances of that. Most of those instances fall outside of Chapter 973, which is the chapter that we're looking at and that presumably is most relevant to interpreting the particular statute that we're interpreting. But of course, there's other tools of statutory construction that we must use as well. And I think one of the most important ones here is if we look at the statute itself, it requires three things, two of which are really normally at issue in these probation cases. You can't get revoked, and you have to satisfy the conditions. Those are separate requirements. The legislature wrote both of those into the statute for a reason. It didn't mean to just reiterate itself. But if we say that a probationer who violates a single rule or condition is automatically barred from expungement, then there's no point in having the lack of revocation requirement. You can't get revoked unless you violated a rule or condition. So I think within the statute itself, even if we don't look at all of the other places in Chapter 973, which refer to conditions ordered by the court and rules imposed by the department, even if we set all that aside, just within the statute itself, there seems to be no reason for the statute to require perfect compliance with all rules and conditions.
That's why couldn't someone could voluntarily revoke. They could revoke themselves. They're allowed to do that under the law.
I suppose that's true. I don't know how often it would come up, and I'm not sure that the legislature would have intended to bar expungement simply for those individuals that chose to revoke themselves. It appears to me, looking at the legislative history, that originally the requirement was simply no revocation and no new convictions. And then in 1983, the legislature decided to add in this new requirement for satisfaction of conditions. It's not clear to me from the legislative history precisely why. They don't explain precisely why they did that, but my guess is that they did it because they wanted to encourage probationers to pay restitution promptly by the end of probation. At that point in time, this court had recently ruled that probation couldn't be extended for lack of payment of restitution, and there was no civil judgment option. And so this was a way to encourage probationers to actually pay the restitution that otherwise they essentially weren't required to pay. And so I think that's also why this requirement is phrased in terms of satisfaction, a positive requirement that you have to satisfy the condition, rather than the negative requirement or the negative phrasing of the first two requirements. Don't get convicted of another crime. Don't get revoked. So I think there's a reason for that phrasing. And so even if we're looking just at the statute itself that we have to interpret here, it makes sense to interpret the word conditions to mean conditions ordered by the court. And of course, I've laid out in the briefs the numerous times within Chapter 973 in which the legislature uses the word conditions to refer to court-ordered conditions and uses the word rules to refer to DOC-imposed rules.
Counsel, even if conditions could be imposed by either probation or the court, here we have a situation where the probation officer completed that form, the certificate of discharge and satisfaction of probation conditions, checking off the box saying they're satisfied, and the circuit court said they're satisfied. So is there something in the statute that would necessitate not going with those determinations? Is there any, how do we know what satisfied is, and how do we, what do we do with the fact that it, both the court and probation said it was satisfied here?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I agree. I think both parties that have a say under the statute indicated that Mr. Lick is satisfied the conditions, and that should be the end of the story. We know from Hemp and Ozuna that there can sometimes be issues with a truly automatic expungement process, right? It would be so easy if each case featured a probation agent who said, yep, all the conditions have been satisfied, nobody disagreed, expungement happens automatically. But that's not always what happens, and that's what we learned in Ozuna, and that's what we see here as well. In Ozuna, there was a slightly different disagreement. Everybody agreed that there had been a violation of a condition. Here, there isn't that agreement. So the agreement between the probation agent and the judge was they both looked at what Mr. Lickis had done and agreed that he had satisfied the conditions of probation. The state came in, the prosecutor came in and tried to disagree with that. The judge held a hearing, in fact, held two hearings, which I think is the proper procedure when there is a disagreement. Ozuna hints at that. And then the judge considered all the record before him, considered the party's arguments, and agreed that Mr. Lickis had satisfied the conditions. So ultimately, whether we read the statute to include rules or not, Judge Beer found that Mr. Lickis had satisfied everything he was required to do, and so expungement should be ordered. And it's not for the prosecutor to disagree with that determination. The judge is the one who orders the sentence. The judge is the one who decides that the defendant should be eligible for expungement. The judge is in the best position ultimately to rule as to whether the conditions have been satisfied and whether the sentence has been successfully completed. That's a uniquely judicial function. That's why we elect judges who are accountable to the community to sentence individuals and to decide in their best judgment whether that sentence has been completed to the judge's satisfaction.
I want to ask you about the specific counts here. Count one was a fourth degree sexual assault. Count three was a disorderly conduct, and I'm just going out of order because that's the way the JOC does. And then count four was the exposing genitals count. On that count, the third one, that is, Mr. Likas was placed on probation for a period of 3 years. On the first two counts that I talked about, which were counts one and three, he was placed on probation for a period of 2 years. On all three of those counts, a condition of his probation was that he undergo sex offender treatment and counseling. It's my understanding that he was kicked out of that counseling, did not complete it in the first 2 years. That is, did not complete it during the period of probation for counts one and three. And then finally did complete it in the third year. Is it your argument that it was that he should still be expunged for the fourth degree sexual assault and the disorderly conduct, even though he didn't finish the counseling that was a condition of probation ordered by the judge in years one and two of probation?
So I think you have the general timeline correct, but I would like to offer a bit of an explanation or a correction on precisely what occurred. Judge Beer ordered 3 years of probation. It was only 2 years for counts one and three because that was the statutory maximum allowed. He then set, during sentencing, conditions of probation. He didn't specify certain conditions for certain counts. He just said, all right, I ordered 2 years for these two counts. I ordered 3 years for this count. And now here are the terms and conditions of probation that you have to follow for those 3 years. And one of the conditions was complete. Depends on whether you look at the judgment of conviction or the sentencing transcript, the precise language, but undergo sex offender treatment and counseling. That's what the judgment of conviction said. And so Mr. Lick's probation agent was apparently of the understanding that that means he's supposed to undergo treatment for that three-year period, which is what he did. There is the ATR on the record, which says he was terminated from sex offender treatment. There's no explanation on the record as to exactly what that meant. Nobody discussed it because the state wasn't relying on it during the expungement hearings before Judge Beer as a basis on which to deny expungement. My guess is that I think it's quite likely that he was terminated because he had to go to jail for 45 days under the terms of the ATR, and therefore he was not able to attend the sex offender treatment classes. So he resumed treatment as soon as he came back out, once the ATR was done, and he successfully completed it. So that's why that first form filed by the probation agent, which is sort of like a status update, right? We're 2 years in, I'm letting you know what's going on. He's done everything he's supposed to so far. He's still participating in treatment. And then the third form, or the second form, that's filed at the end of the three-year period, that's the final say on how he performed during probation. And that form says he satisfied every condition. Judge Beer discussed this on the record at the hearing, looked at those two forms and said, yep, I wanted him to complete the treatment, to undergo treatment throughout the three-year period. I didn't mean for him to complete it only within the first 2 years. And so Judge Beer decided that Mr. Lick's actions had satisfied the condition that Judge Beer imposed. That was his decision. And he's really in the best position to make that decision because he's the one who ordered the condition in the first place. He knows what he wanted to see, and he decided that Mr. Lickes did what he wanted him to do.
But what you're saying is, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is he's ordered to go to sex offender counseling and he couldn't do it because he got an ATR, which makes it sound like there was some outside influence that came in and imposed this alternative to revocation. And there was an ATR because he wasn't doing what he was supposed to do on probation. You don't get to an ATR otherwise. So it's not like, you know, he was sick and he was in the hospital and so he couldn't get to a sex offender treatment. That's not what happened. There was an ATR because he wasn't complying with the rules, conditions of probation. They didn't alternate. He could have been revoked, but they said, we're going to give you yet another chance. You've already gotten on probation. That's one chance. You haven't said it complied with the rules. We'll give you another one. Now we're going to give you an ATR instead of revoking you. So I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around that.
Well, I would point out that the ATR, which is filed on the record, Mr. Lickes signed that without the benefit of counsel. He signed it before Ozuna had been issued. So at that point, it would have appeared, even if he had been represented by counsel, his counsel probably would have told him, yeah, this is fine. It won't affect your eligibility for expungement. You know, you can go ahead and sign it. But the basis for the ATR was also discussed on the record, the two hearings before Judge Beer on expungement. And Judge Beer noted that the basis for the ATR was a polygraph test that the agent thought Mr. Lickes had failed. It's unclear whether he actually could have been revoked because the sole basis for the revocation would have been an inadmissible polygraph test result. But all that aside, Mr. Lickes chose to sign the ATR and go to jail for 45 days rather than risk, in his view, what would be the risk of revocation and therefore absolutely the loss of expungement eligibility.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding the ATR, but it's my understanding that what had to do with the polygraph was the fact that Mr. Lickes was involved in a relationship with another woman that the agent didn't know about it. And he admitted it, that's even on the record in the colloquy with Judge Beer that he was in fact. So whether or not the polygraph was part of it, he was doing something that was in violation. And this is someone who is convicted of sexual assault, who is ordered to go to sex offender treatment, whose agent is trying to keep the people of the state of Wisconsin safe by keeping an eye on what he is doing. He is not complying with the rules of probation. He's not going to sex offender treatment. And now we're supposed to consider the expungement on those two counts. I'm just really struggling with this.
Ultimately, you're correct. The agent had him sign an ATR. The agent felt that was in his best interest and the public's best interest. And the agent at the end of those 3 years signed a form indicating that he had successfully completed probation and had satisfied all of the conditions. That's what the agent said in the end. Whether we choose to incorporate rules into the statute or not, ultimately the agent has an important task to fulfill when determining whether expungement occurs. The agent has the task of reporting to the judge and to the court what occurred and whether they believe that the conditions were satisfied or not. And here the agent said he satisfied them. He did what we asked him to. He should get expungement. That's what the agent said. And the judge agreed. The judge had an opportunity to review the record, had an opportunity to review both of those forms filed by the agent and the ATR. And Judge Beer said, this guy did what I wanted him to do. He successfully completed probation. I already ordered him eligible for expungement. I can't go back on that now. We know that from him. He gets expungement now. He has satisfied his conditions.
Counsel, if imagine that, you know, the form comes to the court saying, you know, the conditions of probation were satisfied, successfully completed probation. You know, prosecutor comes in and says, well, I mean, he clearly violated this condition of probation. Let's say one of those ones set by the department under the administrative rules or under the statutes, the multiple statutes that say some conditions of probation set by the department. I hear you advocating for the idea that the court could nonetheless determine that this is sufficient to constitute satisfy, that the conditions of probation have been satisfied. Even if, so let's say it's undisputed that one of the conditions of probation has not in fact been complied with. but you're advocating for the court to have discretion to nonetheless make that determination. Is that a fair summary of your argument in that context?
Yes, I think it's a very limited discretion, certainly. I'm not trying to go back on hemp at all. But ultimately, the statute says you get expungement upon successful completion of the sentence, and someone has to decide whether the sentence has been completed successfully. And for the first two requirements, that's a pretty easy decision to make. But when it comes to satisfaction of conditions, that's a more difficult question. And again, the way it's phrased, it doesn't say no violations of conditions. The statute says satisfaction of conditions. And so it would appear to me that a sentencing judge, would have the discretion to hear the facts and decide whether the conditions were satisfied. I don't think any judge would want a probationer who is 5 minutes late to a meeting to have expungement deemed to be ineligible for expungement because they were 5 minutes late one time, but otherwise performed perfectly throughout their entire 3-year term of probation, right? Technically, that's a violation. And that's what the state wants you to do, is say any technical violation, a single one, no more expungement. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's what a court or a trial judge would want, although of course it would be within their discretion still to determine, man, I really wanted you to show up every time and you didn't that one time, so you haven't satisfied, no expungement. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Rosenau, are you ready to proceed?
I am, thank you.
Please do.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Scott Rosenau for the state of Wisconsin. The legislature did not intend for defendants like Jordan Lickies to receive expungement. Lickies was convicted on 4 counts, including 1 felony, because he had sex with a 16-year-old girl when he was 19. The circuit court gave him a second chance at the sentencing hearing when it found him eligible for expungement, contingent on his successful completion of probation. Lickies spurned that second chance when he admittedly violated 3 conditions of probation. He now asked his court to extend him a third chance. It should decline to do so because his admitted probation violations made him ineligible for expungement. And before I get too deep into my argument, I realize there is a glare behind me. So if the court wants me to close the window blinds, I certainly can do that. Other than that, I would like to address a point that Attorney White made at the end of her argument first. So she said that.
I think that it makes you look more almost like a halo, like beatifies you. So I think keep it on.
I look better in the dark is what you're saying. Okay.
Well, you could interpret it that way. Thank you.
So Attorney White said that in the state's view, a defendant would be denied expungement if he shows up 5 minutes late to a meeting. And I want to go into a little more depth on that issue. And first of all, that's not the state's position. The state doesn't think somebody would be denied expungement under those circumstances. But I do want to explore that issue a little bit more, because I realize that although the court doesn't decide hypothetical facts, the court is rightly concerned in some cases how its decision would apply in future contexts. So I want to bring the court's attention to a case called State versus Lowe. It's spelled L-O. It's from 1999. It's a court of appeals case. And I'll find the citation here in a second, but it's 228 Wes 2nd, 531 at pages 538 through 39. And what the Court of Appeals says right there is probation conditions, just like statutes, are interpreted with common sense to avoid absurd results. So I realize that there are some standard rules of supervision that say things like meet with your agent for scheduled appointments, report all contacts with law enforcement to your agent, that sort of thing. And Lickie's opening brief says that under the state's view, defendants would be denied expungement for things like not telling their agent that a cop said hi to them on the street, or missing one meeting because they had car trouble, or showing up 5 minutes late to a meeting. And just to be clear, the state does not think that those innocent behaviors would constitute rule violations. So defendants would not be revoked or denied expungement for those things.
All right, I want to push back on that, Attorney Rosenau, because some of these conditions are things like you can't drive a car without permission. You can't put anything on credit. So pretty much can't use a credit card without permission. I mean, there's a lot of conditions. The framework you've set up for us is one that you would essentially have, I'm not sure who you would have review whether these are substantial or not substantial, because in this case, we've got the party who knows best, which is probation, putting a form into the court saying these conditions have been met, they've been satisfied. The court then agreeing they've been satisfied, and the state then saying, oh no, they haven't. So under that framework, it seems like you could have the state come in and challenge any one of these things, which I'm sure multiple people do all the time, break rules here and there, as saying what's substantial and what's not. So how does your framework not put us in that untenable position, or put the court in that untenable position?
Well, a few things in response. So I think the Ozuna Court's interpretation of the statute is really where that position comes from, that it's not up to the court or the agent to decide whether the violation is substantial. It's just whether there was a violation at all. And what the defendant in Ozuna did was he drank alcohol in violation of a condition that he maintained absolute sobriety. So that seems less serious than what happened here. But the Ozuna Court did not talk about whether the violation in that case was substantial or not. It was just whether he violated his condition or not, and he did.
So right, but the language isn't about violation. I mean, that's not what the statute says. It says whether his conditions have been satisfied. So I don't read Ozuna to equate a violation with not satisfying conditions, because if that's the case, then we're even at the point where 5 minutes late gets you, or not showing up to one appointment out of 50 gets you no expungement, right? If you're saying it's just a violation, who determines whether it's satisfied or not?
So I do read in Ozuna a little bit differently than you do, Your Honor. Ozuna does, this court in Ozuna did equate the violation of a condition of probation with the failure to satisfy probation. And the Ozuna court said, Mr. Ozuna violated one condition of probation, therefore he did not satisfy the conditions of probation. But just to be clear, I don't think that these minor things like showing up 5 minutes late, first of all, agents would never report that sort of thing to a court. And even if they did, I don't think any prosecutor or judge in their right mind would say showing up 5 minutes late constitutes a violation, because again, rules have to be interpreted reasonably to avoid absurd results. And I think it would be absurd to say that a defendant is in violation of the rules of probation because he missed a meeting because he had car trouble, or showed up 5 minutes late because his bus was late, or something like that. So I really don't think that defendants would be denied expungement for things like missing a single meeting. I do agree that those sorts of things happen all the time. Defendants do show up late, their meetings have to get rescheduled, and that sort of thing just doesn't go reported to the circuit courts. I don't think anybody did as a violation.
Counsel, so that's a wonderful practical argument that the parade of horribles is unlikely to occur, but you still, I think, need to deal with a legal question, which is why wouldn't that be the case? Imagine the prosecutor's really somebody's really concerned here, right? Imagine it is reported to the court. Imagine this person did not show up to his meeting on time 5 times over his 3-year probation. It's brought to the court. You should deny him expungement on those grounds. How does your legal argument tell the circuit court how to deal with that question?
Well, I think that's where the appellate courts come into play. So if the circuit court denies expungement for something like showing up late to a meeting by 5 minutes, then the defendant could appeal and in all likelihood would prevail on appeal. And that's why it's not simply up to the agent or the circuit court to decide whether somebody has satisfied the conditions of probation. It's a factual matter about what happened, and then it's a legal question about whether those facts amount to a rule violation. And just to be clear, again, this court doesn't resolve hypothetical facts, so it doesn't have to address in its opinion whether these things would amount to rule violations, but I don't think they would. I don't think any prosecutor or judge would think that showing up late to a meeting constitutes a rule violation. But
that doesn't quite answer it. So I'm going to give you another try at that. The fact that there's appellate review doesn't really answer the question of what the court is supposed to do. How does that get determined? There's grades of all kinds, right? So we're talking about what is a condition of probation. And we're talking about the circuit court's ability to deal with asserted violations of conditions of probation set by the department potentially, or maybe even the court. So I need to know how you would deal with that, other than that seems a little absurd, so it probably doesn't apply. Maybe that works, but it doesn't work for me. So can you try one more time for me?
Sure. So I think this court's precedents give a lot of answers to all the little, I guess, facets of how things would play out. So we know from cases like Matusek, Hemp, and Arbery, which are all unanimous decisions by this court since 2014, one of them I think was 2017, this court held in all three of those cases that a circuit court has discretion to order expungement at one point in time only, at the sentencing hearing. There's no discretion after the sentencing hearing. So I don't think it would be a discretionary call on the circuit court's part to say, is this infraction or whatever you want to call it serious enough to warrant expungement? Because if you say, yes, there's discretion, then that's overruling him. And nobody wants to do that, because we don't want Justice Hagedorn's hypothetical to be turned the other way around and have a circuit court judge say, you know what, you technically comply with all the rules, but I still don't like what you did here and there, so I'm going to deny you expungement. We don't want to give circuit courts discretion, because that would be overruling him. And so what the question boils down to is the circuit judge decides what the facts are and decides how to apply the law to the facts. So if the discharge form says something like the client missed one meeting because his bus broke down, I think a circuit court judge would say, well, if that's the only alleged violation, I'm going to say as a matter of law that is not a rule violation, so you get expungement. If the discharge form says the defendant did not attend all meetings as required, there might need to be a hearing in the circuit court to decide what the facts are. If the agent testifies that the defendant said, I'm sick of you, I'm not attending any more meetings with you, I think then the defendant's in violation of the rules and he wouldn't get expungement. If, on the other hand, the agent says to the court, oh, I should have been more clear in the discharge form, all I meant was he showed up 5 minutes late, then the circuit court would say, okay, that's not a rule violation, you get expungement. I think that's how it plays out. So it's a factual issue over what happened, and it's a legal question over, with de novo appellate review, whether the facts amount to rule violation or not. And even if the court were inclined to interpret Ozuna differently than I am and say that Ozuna requires courts to decide whether a violation is serious or not, or significant or not, I think that certainly that test, although that's not the test, that hypothetical test would be met in this case, because Lickey's rule violations are more serious than the one in Ozuna. Again, the defendant in Ozuna consumed alcohol despite having a absolute sobriety condition of probation, and that single consumption of alcohol was why he was denied expungement, why he lost his entitlement to expungement. And Lickey's did more than that. He had unimproved sexual contact despite being convicted of 4 counts related to a sex offense. He was required to register as a sex offender for about 4 years until 2025 because the court said it was concerned enough to make him register. And he had unimproved contact, sexual contact. He lied to his agent, presumably about the contact and the relationship he was having, and he was terminated from sex offender treatment. And I think the DOC, whether it matters or not, I don't really think it does, but DOC apparently deemed those violations serious because it prompted Lickey's to enter into an alternative to revocation agreement. And he went to jail for 45 days. That's a long time. A day in jail would be a long time for me, but 45 days in jail is a month and a half. That's a long time. And he agreed to go to jail to avoid revocation proceedings. So I don't see how somebody who serves an extra month and a half in jail to avoid getting revoked, I don't see how they have successfully completed their sentence or satisfied the conditions of probation.
Mr. Osno, to follow up on a question that Justice Dallet asked Attorney White a little while ago, what about the fact, though, when the attorney filled out this form, the box was marked saying that probation had been completed successfully? What do we do with that?
I think the decision by this court in Ozuna already answers that question, that the entitlement to expungement does not hinge on what the discharge form says. The discharge form is certainly relevant if it provides facts showing that there's a violation of the conditions, but the discharge form is not the be-all, end-all, because even in the Ozuna case, the form checked a box that said the defendant has successfully completed his sentence. Although below that, it said he did not satisfy all the conditions. So that form, according to the defendant in that case, he argued that the form showed that his agent thought he had satisfied the agent by successfully completing the sentence, despite that one rule violation. And this court held that the defendant had violated the condition of probation and therefore had not successfully completed the sentence, despite some contradictory content on the form.
Isn't Ozuna distinguishable because of that contradictory information on the form? We don't have any contradictory information on the form here or what the agent is telling the court, which is that he successfully satisfied probation, right? Well, I mean, isn't that different? It's different if you've got a situation where there's contradictory information, whereas here you don't, right?
No, we do have contradictory information in a couple of ways. So first of all, there are two discharge forms in this case. The earliest one was regarding counts 1 and 3, the misdemeanors. The second one is regarding count 4, the felony. The first of those two forms does have contradictory information. It says that Lickies has not successfully completed the conditions of probation because he still hasn't completed sex offender treatment. The second of those two forms, I'll admit, doesn't have any contradictory information on its face. But when you look at the entire record, which I think is what Ozuna directs courts to, it says if the record shows that you have failed the conditions, and that means you don't get expungement. In this case, the record includes the ATR agreement, which Lickies signed. It's a 2-page document. It's in the record. And Lickies admitted to violating those three conditions of probation that I just described. So I think the most recent of those two discharge forms does contradict what the ATR agreement says, where Lickies admitted to violating three conditions.
Counsel, we need interpretations and the system needs rules that are clear and easy to administer. Your argument focuses on something that a minor violation, the judge can say, a minor violation as a matter of law is not a rule violation. So let's say the judge decides 5 itsy-bitsy violations are not a rule violation. And then you say de novo review, and the Court of Appeals says, 5 itsy-bitsy are a rule violation, but it had been 3, it wouldn't have been. I mean, aren't we getting into the number and the nature of rule violations? Isn't it easier to focus on the words of the statute, whether or not the defendant is deemed to satisfy the conditions of probation? If someone makes that determination rather than de novo review, I mean, you're saying a violation is not a violation unless as a matter of law, it's deemed a violation. That seems to me to open up a can of worms, and then you give de novo review to that? Are 5 itsy-bitsy? Are 7 itsy-bitsy? Are 3 itsy-bitsy? How itsy-bitsy is itsy-bitsy? Can you answer that question?
Yeah, sure. So a few things in response. So I guess, first of all, I wouldn't agree with the phrasing of the question, because I wouldn't phrase it as a small violation. I would just say things like showing up late to a meeting is not a violation at all. So I wouldn't call it a small violation. I just say it's innocent behavior that nobody would think is a violation.
Okay, counsel, but previously in your argument, you didn't say small, you said minor, but I took that to be small. If the circuit court determines if it's a minor violation, whether or not the minor violation constitutes, I'm no longer reading from my notes, just my recollection, if that minor violation constitutes a violation as a matter of law, then you get to the question of whether or not it satisfies the condition of probation. So you're not saying minor violation, unless I wrote down my notes incorrectly, but I think this part I did write correctly. You used minor violation.
I think you're right, and I'm not sure what part of my argument I was using that term. I might have been using it when I was talking about this alternative interpretation of Ozuna that minor violations are okay, but serious ones aren't. So I think
that's correct. It's in response to Justice Stout's question regarding Ozuna. And her question was, Ozuna did not say a violation equals a failure to satisfy a condition of probation. And you said, yes, it does. Mm-hmm.
Right. I think under the Ozuna opinion, the majority opinion, I think a violation of a probation condition, which includes DOC rules, I think that does constitute the failure to satisfy the conditions of probation. So the big question, I guess two of them, one is, what constitutes a rule violation and what doesn't? And in this case, you don't have to answer that question because Lickey's admitted to violating three conditions. The second big question, I think, is the one that Attorney White led with in her opening remarks when she said, basically, who decides? And she seemed to be saying that the agent and circuit court should each get to decide. Although in her briefs, she said it's up to the circuit court judge. It's not up to the agent. So don't look at the ATR agreement. That's just the probation agent's doing. Look at what the circuit court judge said. In Ozuna, the defendant made the exact opposite argument. He said, the circuit judge shouldn't have denied me expungement. It's not up to that judge. It's up to the agent who filled out the form that said I completed my probation. And I think the court in Ozuna, as well as earlier cases like Mattisek and Hemp, rejected both of those notions. It's not up to the agent. It's not up to the discharge form. It's not up to the circuit court judge as a matter of discretion to decide whether the defendant has satisfied the conditions. What matters is what the facts are and whether those amount to a rule violation. And here, we have three admitted rule violations. So I don't think the court needs to really go down the rabbit hole of what's a rule violation and what's not. But I do realize that Justice Braley has a dissenting opinion in Ozuna. That does,
that,
does raise
that some, I thought was quite good.
It does raise
what
some
do you think?
Well, it does raise some valid concerns about basically like a slippery slope concern. Like if this is enough to deny somebody expungement, what about missing the meeting? What about not reporting that a police officer says hello to you in the street, that sort of thing? And I just want to, first of all, tell the court, you don't have to go there because that's not this case. You shouldn't decide hypothetical questions. But furthermore, I just wanted to alleviate some of those concerns and say, don't worry, I highly doubt anybody would ever be denied expungement on those grounds. And if they were, that's why appellate de novo review is a wonderful thing.
Ms. Trostel, can I ask you just a question about the facts in this case regarding the ATR? And I'm a little unclear. The ATR happened during those first 2 years of probation or during the third year?
About 1 year into the first term, I think. I do have a timeline in my notes somewhere. So he was placed on probation in January 2014. The ATR was filed in circuit court October 2015. So about maybe a year and a half or a little more into the first 2 years of probation. So it was during all of the probation terms, the three concurrent ones. And if, a little bit about the facts of that form. So I think it's unfortunate, but we don't have more in the record to explain what exactly those violations are. We don't have the rules that the agent imposed. We don't have like a document showing all the rules that the agent imposed. All we really have is that form saying Lickey agrees to these rule violations. And I think the reason why we don't have more in the record is because Lickey said he agreed to those three violations and agreed to serve extra time in jail as a result in lieu of revocation proceedings. So I don't think that the DA's office really wanted to supplement the record with a bunch of other documents, because I don't think the DA's office thought Lickey's would later sort of dispute whether these violations actually happened once he realized that they would deprive him of expungement. So I think that I wouldn't call it gamesmanship, but I think Lickey's possibly understood that if he got revoked, he'd lose expungement. So that's presumably one of the reasons why he agreed to go to jail in lieu of revocation proceedings. And then when the DA's office later said, well, hold on, you admitted to these violations, you don't get expungement, even if you weren't revoked. That's when he started to dispute whether he actually violated these conditions or not. But I think it's first, oh, I see Justice Dale has unmuted herself.
So yeah, I think it's really important, regardless of the facts of this case, that we have a framework here about how to deal with this. I mean, that's to me what this case is about in the larger picture. So if you were to say there's a rule that comes out of this based on the statutory language, what is it? Is it that, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that the court has to decide if a violation is substantial or not. And I don't see that in the statute. And I don't know, and even though you're so confident that no one's ever gonna be denied expungement based on failure to show up at a meeting with their agent, I'm not so confident. Nor do I think that's what the statute was intended to get at. So if you're looking at the statutory language, who determines satisfaction? And how does this work in your mind?
So just to be clear, I'm not saying that the issue is whether there was a substantial violation or not, because I agree that's not in the language of the statute. And the Ozuna court, the majority opinion, held that Ozuna had not satisfied the conditions of probation because he violated a single condition. So I think that the Ozuna majority opinion does equate a violation with the failure to satisfy the conditions of probation. So the test is, did the defendant, it does the, under Ozuna, the test is, does the record show that the defendant violated one or more conditions of probation? And really the big question that I haven't really addressed yet, but Attorney White addressed it more in her argument, is whether that phrase in the statute refers to just court-imposed conditions or also DOC-imposed conditions. And I do want to address that issue at least briefly, if I may. So I believe that even under Lickey's logic, so Lickey's argument is that DOC rules are not court-imposed rules, and that the two violations, the first two violations that were noted on the ATR form, the unapproved contact and the false statement to the agent, his argument is those weren't court-imposed condition violations. Those are just DOC rule violations, so they don't matter under the expungement statute. And I just want to point out that I think under Lickey's logic, had the circuit court judge at sentencing said, Mr. Lickey, you must comply with all DOC rules and regulations of probation, I think there'd be no dispute at this point that his DOC rule violations would also constitute court condition violations. So I really don't think that granting him relief, it would be good for him maybe, but it wouldn't be good for other defendants, because circuit court judges will just start reading the standard rules of supervision at sentencing hearings and saying, I'm explicitly making you comply with all these rules as well as anything your agent imposes. Then in that case, DOC rules and regulations would automatically be court-ordered conditions, even under Lickey's logic. So I think it would be pretty hollow relief to interpret the expungement statute in a way that would allow defendants to violate DOC rules with impunity. I don't think that's what it was meant to do.
Okay, so at this hearing with the court, is it the court's job then to ask about every single condition and rule to determine if they've been violated? Because I guarantee that if you go through every single one of these rules and conditions, and assuming they're both applicable, that if the court's job is to have a hearing and to determine evidence and to tease out the facts, which you're putting on the circuit court at this point, and they go through each and every one of these conditions, pretty much I would think at every single probationer would violate something. So, I mean, is that what the court's supposed to do? Because you're not putting a lot of faith in this form that says that the conditions were met and satisfied.
No, just to be clear, when I talked about hearing and the court listing different things, so all I'm saying is if this court holds that the court of appeals unanimous decision below was wrong, the expungement statute does not refer to DOC rules, it just refers to court-imposed conditions. If this court goes that route, then circuit courts at sentencing will simply say, I am explicitly requiring you to comply with all DOC rules, which would effectively render the court's decision in this case moot, because now DOC rules would constitute court-imposed conditions. But my next point is that the process that was established in Ozuna and Hemp is that expungement is meant to be a self-executed process, meaning it doesn't generally have to be a hearing. The defendant doesn't have to do anything. All that happens is DOC sends a discharge form as a matter of course to the circuit court once the defendant finishes his probation. If the circuit court looks at that form and says, yep, you satisfied all the conditions, then the court expunges the record without any involvement from the defendant. That's a self-executing process. There's no hearing, nothing. It's just circuit court does its job, DOC does its job, defendant doesn't have to do anything. The issue is when something in the record, like the discharge form in Ozuna or like the ATR agreement in this case, if something in the record shows that the defendant violated conditions of probation, then the circuit court should deny expungement if those violations were conceded like they were in this case. Or at least if the circuit court is unsure about whether there was a violation, like if the discharge form says the defendant missed a single meeting, then the circuit court at that point might want to hold a hearing to flesh out the facts and decide what happened. And that's what I talked about earlier today when I said, if the circuit court holds a hearing and the agent says the defendant just stopped attending any meetings because he was tired of meeting with me, I think that would be a rule violation. But if the agent says, oh, he missed a single meeting because his bus broke down, Well, I think in that case, the circuit court judge would obviously say, okay, that's not a violation, to get expungement. So that's where the hearing comes into play. I don't think, generally speaking, there should not be hearings like there were in this case. I think there were in this case just because there was some dispute, first of all, maybe over the facts, especially whether he satisfied the treatment requirement. But I think there was a bigger question about the legal issue. Do these rule violations trigger the Ozuna rule? In other words, are DOC rule violations on equal footing with court condition violations? And I think that's why there were so many circuit court briefs and multiple hearings on the issue to flesh out that legal question. And that's where the circuit court said a lot of different things that are plainly wrong. And Lickes didn't even defend most of it reasoning on appeal, like relying on the Ozuna dissent, relying on pending legislation, that sort of thing. But the one thing the circuit court seemed to say, the one kind of hook on appeal, was Ozuna does not apply to DOC rules. It just applies to court imposed conditions. And that's where the Court of Appeals unanimously reversed and said, no, the expungement statute requires defendants to comply with court ordered conditions and DOC ordered conditions alike. And 97309, 97310 do the same thing. All three of those statutes require defendants to comply with DOC rules of probation in addition to court imposed rules. So unless there are more questions, I think I've said everything I needed to say.
Okay, thank you very much. You. Attorney White, rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to where I started this morning. This case is about who decides whether a term of probation has been satisfactorily completed. I heard several of you essentially ask the question, who decides, during the course of Mr. Rosenau's arguments, and I didn't hear a satisfactory answer. I heard him say, look at the record. But who's supposed to look at the record? The state's looking at the record in this case and saying the conditions haven't been satisfied, but the probation agent and the judge looked at the record in this case and said, yep, he's satisfied. He satisfactorily met all of the conditions and he's entitled to expungement. I heard Mr. Rosenau say at one point that the Court of Appeals could fix any error at the trial court level on this issue. To me, that sounds like he's admitting that it is the judge who gets to decide whether a sentence has been successfully completed. And again, the court looked here and decided that the sentence had been successfully completed. Ultimately, The probation agent has an important role to play in reporting the facts and reporting any violations that the probation agent believes occurred. But ultimately, sentencing is a judicial function, and it's really important that the judge be able to decide what the conditions are, whether expungement should occur at the initial sentencing hearing, and at the end of the sentence, whether the probationer has earned the expungement that he was eligible for. It's really important.
Counsel, just want to ask a question. In Ozuna, if the trial court had received this form, indicated there was drinking of alcohol, but did the trial court, in your view, have discretion to say, I'm nonetheless going to grant expungement in this situation? I understood your opposing counsel's argument to be no, that Ozuna settled that matter. And I'm curious how you would respond to that.
I don't believe Ozuna settled that matter. The court said in Ozuna that the trial court didn't abuse its discretion by denying expungement, but it didn't, the majority opinion didn't hold that the trial court would have abused its discretion by ordering expungement. I don't know the facts of that case. Maybe it would have been an erroneous exercise of discretion. And in that case, I think, you know, there would have to be a hearing and the judge would have to decide whether in his or her view, the condition was satisfied. But I think there is that option. Ozuna leaves open that option. And essentially that's what occurred here. Judge Beer considered the facts. He heard arguments from both sides. He absolutely heard a lot of legal arguments. There was a lot of confusion over what the law allowed and what the law required. But ultimately, he decided that Mr. Lickes had satisfied the conditions that Judge Beer set for him. And and allowed expungement to go forward, just as expungement had been promised to Mr. Lickes at the sentencing hearing. And I really do want to focus on the importance of the judicial role in sentencing. Not only do we elect judges to fulfill that purpose, but the court is the appropriate place for these decisions to be made. That's where the victim has notice and can appear at the hearings and offer input, which is not the case with a probation agent making the decision, let alone a prosecutor on their own. It's also the place where the defendant has a right to counsel, where the public is available to appear. That's the place where these decisions should ultimately be made, with the probation agent's input, which is very valuable. But the judge is the one who makes the decision. And I think if you really listen, as I listened to Mr. Rosenau's argument, that's essentially what he was saying, is ultimately it is the judicial function to make these decisions about whether a sentence has been successfully completed. So I ask that you would uphold the judge's decision here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. It's a very interesting case, and the briefing was quite good. So I thank you for that as well. We are now going to adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. We are adjourned.